I want you to imagine for a moment that when you die, that's it. It's all over. No afterlife, no rewards, no punishments, no heaven, and no hell. If you believe that to be true, would you still want to be a Christian? This is a very probing question because it gets right down to our motivation. Why have you decided to be a Christian? Is it because we're selfish and superficial? For many Christians, the line of reasoning goes as follows. I feel badly about how I am living or have lived my life. Hell is the punishment for sinners, and I am a sinner. I don't want to go to hell. I want to live forever in heaven. So I need my sins forgiven. And I want innocent Jesus to die in my place so that he can suffer and accept punishment on my behalf. I want to be rescued, reprieved, and reborn. And I want to go to heaven when I die or become part of Christ's kingdom, whatever that is. And I want whatever other blessings, gifts, and benefits that might be available for Christians today. That is quite often the message the church gives to people for why they should become Christian. Now, is it wrong to reach out and accept help from a perceived rescuer when you are in perceived danger? Obviously not. It would be foolish not to do so. But should being in danger and being offered rescue, should feeling needy and being offered a provider be the main reason for becoming a follower of Christ? In the 17th century, Blaise Pascal, a French philosopher, mathematician, physicist, and Catholic theologian, proposed something that has come to be known as Pascal's wager. Pascal was writing in a time of profound change for the church. It was the age of reason, and many people were not only questioning the authority of the church, they were questioning whether or not God even existed. And Pascal argued that there was no way to rationally prove that God did or did not exist, because you can't see God, you can't touch God, you can't feel God, you can't smell God. It's a matter of faith. And so he concluded that a rational person should live as though God did exist and seek to believe God. He said, if God does not actually exist, then such a person who believes in him anyway will have only a finite loss. Maybe some pleasures that you've given up, some luxury, etc. Whereas that person stands to receive infinite gains as represented by eternity in heaven, and avoid infinite loss, eternity in hell, if God does exist. So Pascal was proposing that the main benefit of acting as if God was real, even if you really didn't think he was, or if you weren't sure, was that A, it wouldn't bring you any harm to do so, and B, just in case God actually did exist, you had covered your bets. For unbelievers and skeptics, it was like an insurance policy. You're paying into the account, but you hope that you'll never need to use it. Above all, says Pascal, you must not put yourself in jeopardy by risking an eternity in hell just in case God is real. Now, to me, this is the ultimate expression of self-preservation, a motivation that many Christians are perhaps rightly accused of following. So I get back to my original question. Are there higher and more noble reasons for being a Christian than saving yourself? Well, I think there are. I think Christianity should be lived for today first and foremost. And if we do that, then I believe that tomorrow will take care of itself because we will have lived in harmony with God. And I have three reasons why I would be a Christian even if there were no future reward for being one. Okay, let's scrap the term Christian for a moment, because that carries too much doctrinal and theological and institutional baggage. It's very difficult to separate the idea of being a Christian from the intensity of the theology of how filthy and how corrupt and how sinful we are from birth, how hostile we are by nature to God. And of course, the church will have the solution to the problem of your depravity, depending on which part of the fragmented and disjointed church you are referring to. So let's pull back from the doctrine of your filthiness and your unacceptability to God. What if we approach the question from the point of view of simply being a follower of Jesus the Christ? Why would you want to follow Jesus as a disciple if there was no eternal life and no eternal reward for doing so? Well, my first reason comes from a line in a familiar song written by Jill Jackson Miller and Cy Miller in 1955. And the song is probably familiar to you all. The title is, "Let There Be Peace on Earth, But Let It Begin With Me." This song was initially written for and sung by the International Children's Choir in Long Beach, California. But what's most interesting to me is that Jackson Miller had been suicidal after the failure of her marriage. And she later said that she wrote the song after discovering what she called the life-saving, literally for her, the life-saving joy of God's peace and unconditional love. Peace seems to be something that we want everyone else to realize for us. We want them, whoever they are, in our life, in our family, in our circle of friends, in our neighborhood, we want them to stop doing things that make us angry. We want them to stop fighting with us. We want governments and armies to subdue opponents, and we insist that other people stop doing things that make us hostile and angry towards them. Jackson Miller was unhappy with the tumultuous world around her until she realized that there is, in fact, no such thing as finding peace, which is what she was looking for and searching for and failing to find. And she realized you can't find peace because you and I have no control over those other people that seem to be robbing us of our peace. But she realized that she could be at peace and she could give peace, even to her enemies, because of the example she had seen in Jesus. So in a really practical way, when we follow the peacemaking example of Jesus and thereby share the love of God to others, not the indoctrination of God, that never brings peace, never. Not the insistence on theological compliance, that never brings peace, but the peacemaking example of Jesus, we can actually be at peace and thus experience joy in this life, no matter what the circumstances are in our life. Now, we say that Jesus was the Messiah. The Hebrew word is Mashiach. Anyone know what the Greek word is for Messiah? Christ. Same word. Christians believe that the Hebrew people were mistaken, that the Messiah was destined to fulfill a spiritual role primarily, not a physical one. So a follower of Jesus the Christ would surely want to come to understand what his role was, what he brought as Messiah, what he was attempting to do, and then a follower of Jesus would join him in that same work. Does that make sense? If you are a follower of the master, of the rabbi, if you are the disciple, the student of Jesus, you would understand his ministry, his work, his goals and objectives, and you would want to join him in that work and do similar kind of work. So what was Jesus attempting to do? We already have established that he wasn't attempting to start a new church or a new religion. So why is it that most of Christianity is a perpetuation of a church that he didn't start? At its most basic level, followers of Messiah carry out the work of the Messiah to be a blessing to the world. So I ask you, is that really what Christians are to non-Christians? A blessing. Is that how non-Christians perceive Christians in the world around them? Do non-Christians consider Christians to be a blessing in their midst? If not, something is wrong. Something has failed. I would say we are a blessing of peace in particular, which was what Jesus was aiming to be, to bring peace, harmony between people in their relationships, between people and their God, thus the need to have the two greatest commandments, love God and love your neighbor. That was to bring peace. That was his central message. And we, as disciples or followers of Jesus in this life today, are only a blessing to the world if we also are restoring and rebuilding. Only if we are peacemakers. After the Babylonian captivity ended in 538 BC, the Persian king, Cyrus the Great, released the Israelites to go back home. And because of his assistance, this Persian, pagan, heathen, foreign king, because of his contribution, his assistance, financial and allowing them the freedom to go back and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, the Jews called Cyrus a Messiah. Anyone, in other words, who participates in the work of God by contributing to the work of restoring and rebuilding can also rightly be called a Messiah. And if we understand that as the central role of a Messiah, then we can translate that onto Jesus as one who restored and rebuilt and attempted to bring peace. Specifically, from the Hebrew perspective, the Messiah's task was to usher in the new age of universal, worldwide peace. Jesus didn't accomplish this in his first coming, so it is believed by Christians that he will return to complete his mission. But here's the key. In the meantime, he is building his church as a base for that peace and restoration to occur today. So the church is supposed to be where that advanced behavior, that messianic behavior that will be seen everywhere in the future is displayed now. So again, is there any point in living for today? Or is it all about tomorrow? Is there anything that can make it worthwhile, even if there were no tomorrow, to make this world, this day, a better place because of your belief and your decision to follow Jesus the Christ? And central to that messianic behavior that will bring peace and restoration is love and grace, inclusion and acceptance, all of the hallmarks of the ministry of Jesus, non-judgment, free from racism, sexism, classism, elitism, segregation, and hostility of all kind. That's what Jesus taught. That's what he modeled and demonstrated. And if I say we are disciples of that one who taught this, we have to model that above and beyond any theology or doctrine. In Ephesians 2, verses 13 to 15, Paul said, "But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far away," and that's far away in any sense of the word, far away from God, far away because you're a Gentile and you're not one of the chosen people, far away because you're spiritually a Gentile and also disconnected from God, if you're far away because of broken human relationships, those of you who were away out there, objected to, discriminated against, belittled, considered not included, those of you who were once far away have been brought near, not because of your behavior, but because of the blood of Christ. For he, that is the Messiah, Christ, himself is our peace. Not a belief system, not a church membership, not even a baptism. He is our peace. He is the one who was made two into one and torn down dividing walls of hostility. In other words, to put it very simply, to have Christ in you is to have peace in you. Second reason why I would be a Christian, even if there were no benefit in some afterlife for me, is that Jesus calls us to live a life today of our full human potential. What do we mean by that? When people talk today about human potential, they're usually referring to making the most income possible, or getting the best education, or rising as high as you can in an organization, or enjoying the most adventurous experiences that you can post on Facebook and showing everyone how you have gone higher and further and faster and more daring than anybody else. But Jesus seemed to be saying that from his observations, most people in his day, and it would be true at any time, were only realizing the selfish half of their human potential. Most people, he said, weren't willing to sacrifice for others. The first thing that Jesus did when he began his ministry was to ask 12 individuals to give up their careers, their livelihood, their security, and follow him because his mission was more important than anything else in their lives. And those 12 people said yes. Most people, as Jesus saw it, weren't willing to be authentic. And when you're not authentic, you're not being fully human. That's not your full potential. The people of Jesus' day were particularly concerned about appearing religious. And when you appear to be religious, when you're obsessed with how religious people will think of you, and how good they will think you are, regardless of whether that's true to your nature or not, then you're not living the real life, and you're not living your full potential. Today, people might be more concerned about being cool than religious, but either way, when we worry about what other people think of us, we're not living our full potential. And most people in Jesus' day weren't willing to recognize that a human being also has a spirit within them, a spirit that is holy, a spirit that can lead them without the need of being led by somebody else or by an institution. That there's a spirit within them that, apart from any institution, can inspire them, can comfort them, and yes, even correct them without the need of somebody else telling them how to live their life and teach them to better this life. Not to better this life in order to qualify for the next life, but to benefit and to improve this life for you and your benefit today. And of course, as you are benefited, as I grow as a person, as I live my fuller human potential, then the people around me also benefit. Did Jesus not intend for people to be made whole in this life? Did he not go to great lengths to demonstrate his interest in people's lives today? Was his message simply prepare for the end because the end is near? Did his ministry not address the complex and wide-ranging inadequacies and needs of people of his day? In Matthew 25, Jesus says that when the Son of Man comes in his glory, he will separate sheep from the goats. He says sheep are rewarded because they saw the king hungry and they fed him. And when he was needing clothes, they clothed him. This is a very odd story. Why would a king need assistance at all? And how could sheep help out the king? Well, this is talking about a king who has fallen from power. It's a picture of Jesus rejected and abandoned. And the sheep and the goats metaphorically represent the subjects of the king. And the reason they chose in the parable, the reason Jesus would have chosen sheep and goats, is because it was a well-known symbol of the day that whenever you have your livestock out on the hills grazing, most of the year, they're all mixed in together. But when you go to shear the sheep, or you need to kill some sacrificial lambs, or you need to cull the herd to eat the meat, you have to separate. You can't sell goat meat and call it lamb. And so they would at some point have to separate. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. They kind of look the same. They're about the same size. Sometimes they both have horns. And so it can be a little tricky to make sure you separated them properly. So Jesus is saying that up until this point of separation, the people who are acting religious, the people who claim to be my followers and my subjects, my disciples, the people who go to church, is kind of what he's saying here, all look the same. But they're absolutely not the same. And how do you distinguish? One of the ways he said you distinguish the real ones, the real followers of the Messiah, are the ones who are not obsessed with what will this get for me in the future. The real ones, he says, the real followers are the ones who are saying, what can I do for you today? Because the parable relates to the reward for the righteous, so it's a future parable. But when the disciples said, when did we ever feed you or clothe you? What did we ever do for you today that fits this story? And when did we visit you in prison? And the king replies, this is the representation of Jesus. He says, whatever you did for one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it for me. Whatever you did today, not whatever you plan to do in the future, in heaven or something. He said, what you did for me today, yesterday, that thing you did 5 years ago for someone that no one ever saw, you did it for me. And you did it today, you did it in this life, and you benefited them in this life, and you benefited yourself in this life. And it identifies you as one of my true followers. And he says, don't worry about tomorrow. We'll sort out tomorrow later. We'll sort out the future. But you have to live this life. Even if there were no future, this is how you can live a full human potential. Includes the following of that motivating spirit within you to make the lives of other people better today. Jesus is clearly very concerned with how we make the lives of others better today, not for the reward awaiting the sheep, but because we are more fully using our human potential when we care for others as the opportunities arrive. On Christmas Day, We have for several years now. Beverly and I have a tradition where we go snowshoeing in the mountains trying to find a frozen waterfall. We usually find one because it's usually the same one. But this Christmas, we headed west along Highway 1A, and shortly after driving onto the Stoney Indian Reserve, we spotted a man hitchhiking in the eastbound lane heading towards Calgary or Cochrane or somewhere. The temperature, if you recall, was about minus 25 plus whatever wind chill. And the man was wearing a pair of old shoes, a waist-length jacket, and one glove. And I don't normally stop for hitchhikers. It can be unsafe. And on that day, it was certainly inconvenient. We were heading west, not east. We had plans for the day that were really part of a tradition for us. And it did not include driving back to exactly where we had started from in the first place. And it could have been perceived as a waste of half an hour, 45 minutes. But it was minus 25. And this guy was obviously in a lot of trouble. So we decided to turn around and see if he was okay, at least, even if we couldn't give him a ride or if he didn't need a ride. Joel was his name, and he was nearly frostbitten and hypothermic. He gladly accepted our offer of a lift back to Cochrane, and he eagerly gulped down Beverly's coffee. I asked Joel how long he had been standing on the road waiting for a lift. And I was shocked when he answered, for over 2 hours. For 2 hours, every single vehicle that had traveled east along that road, and even those going west, on the day in the year, the one day in the year that supposedly represents peace and goodwill to all men, even First Nations men who smelt of alcohol, the one day that represented peace and goodwill to all men, every single vehicle for 2 hours had passed by that man. In Luke 8, Jesus shows compassion to a woman who's been impoverished by illness. She spent all the money she had on doctors who couldn't heal her. Her disease has not only robbed her of her livelihood, but it's ruined her reputation. Out of desperation, she touched Jesus' cloak, and she was healed. And after she's healed, Jesus doesn't just move on to the next needy person with his magic wand. He stops and takes time with her, and he talks to her. And so the assumption is she's cursed. She's done something to deserve this. And so she has no status, no reputation. She's dirt. And Jesus doesn't just heal her. He draws attention to the crowd and says, listen to her. Listen to her. He gave her the opportunity to share her miraculous healing with the crowd. We see that in Luke 8, verse 47. Jesus went beyond healing her of her physical affliction to give this poor woman the platform to restore her reputation too. And he's kind of rubbing it in their faces of these judgmental people, these religious people who said, you're not good enough to be part of our community. Does that ever happen today? Have we moved past that as followers and disciples of the Messiah? Jesus is saying to the religious people, stop judging. Stop feeling better than people. Here's a woman who's been healed, and she's not lower than you. Her material poverty was paired with an emotional and spiritual poverty for being labeled unclean for so long, and Jesus healed her of all of that. Even in his last moments of life, what is the last thing Jesus does? He reached out to encourage and to enlighten a criminal about to be crucified. Wouldn't he be most concerned about himself at that point? How many times have we failed to live up to our human potential? I have on many occasions, because we were so preoccupied with our own troubles and our own crises that we failed to even see let alone to respond to the difficulties of others. And third and finally, Christianity, or being a disciple of Jesus, is about freeing ourselves so that we can free others. Put it this way, if the Messiah is portrayed in the Gospels, among other things, as the new Moses, which he is, this is why we have his fleeing to Egypt, because the Pharaoh, a.k.a. Herod, wants to kill him. Jesus is portrayed as the one who's come to release us from the bondage of the slavery of sin. And we cross through the baptism of the Red Sea and the washing of the water and all of that stuff. But sin surely affects us now. And you know what, when you think about it, sin only affects us now. Right? Whatever life there is after this is not going to be affected by sin. It's not going to be changed by sin. There's no dealing with sin. It's all about this life. And it makes sense then that the effects of sin and brokenness and corruption within us are felt in all sorts of ways today. So today is the only day to deal with sin and the effects of sin and brokenness. And sometimes we are the innocent victims of other people's sins. And Christians can and ought to assist whenever the opportunity and the ability present itself to help others who are victims of other people's sins. But sometimes we bring harm to ourselves because of our own sin. And Christians can and ought to rise above that self-inflicted pain by letting the peace of Christ rule in our hearts to free us so that we no longer act as slaves to our lusts and our self-destructive behaviors. And one of the most effective ways to bring freedom into our lives and to bring freedom to the lives of others is the simple, profound act of forgiveness. Forgiving ourselves, forgiving other people, and letting go of animosity and the desire for revenge and the slow, soul-destroying burn of hatred that so many people are so racked with. Jesus empowered those who were trapped in roles or class structures or health limitations by ignoring the boundaries that separates people and thus freeing them from those constraints. And he never placed those constraints on himself. He didn't care that he wasn't the chief priest or the chief rabbi or the chief Pharisee or the chief Sadducee. He was a man who spoke what he believed without fear of others. He was a man who would go into a crowd and talk to the unclean, the tax collectors, the physically unclean, the sick, the diseased, the outcasts of society. How can that not be the main message of the church if it claims to be followers of the Messiah? Bringing peace, not war, not division, not hostility, not exclusion. Someone once said that integrity is what you do when no one's looking. I would add that disciples of Jesus require spiritual integrity. And spiritual integrity is what you do when no one's looking and when there is no expectation of reward. No expectation of heaven. No expectation of a gift of eternal life. Obviously, the reward is appreciated, but it is not a sound principle of pure Christianity to give in order to get, to obey in order to be rewarded. We see this in many of the teachings of Jesus. For example, in Matthew 6, verse 1, he said, when you give to the needy, why are you giving to the needy? In other words, when you want to follow my example, why are you following that? He says, if you go and give to the needy, and then you play a trumpet, a fanfare, and draw everyone's attention to what you just did, as the hypocrites do in the synagogue and on the streets to be praised by men. Truly, he says, I tell you, you've had all the reward you're going to get. Sincerity and motivation and purity of love and purity of action was as essential to Jesus as what you did. There ought to be a purity in love and service. It should not be done for the praise of others. It should not be done for some eternal reward. I want to close with a paragraph from a group of people you might have heard called the Jesus Seminar. The Jesus Seminar has been much maligned in Christian circles, but since 1985, when they formed, their goal has been to attempt to discover the most authentic, the most historically accurate vision of Jesus and what was most central to his ministry. Now, I don't find that goal to be offensive or insulting or eroding of true Christianity. They may, at different times, have been more successful than others in this goal, and they continue to search. But their message, what they have considered and boiled down to its most essential, the most core teaching of Jesus and his value system, they said, at the heart of Jesus' teaching and actions was a vision of a life under the reign of God today. You can call it the empire of God, the kingdom of God, whatever you want to call it, heaven on earth. But central to his teaching was a vision of a reign of God in which God's generosity and goodness is regarded as the model and measure of human life. Everyone, in this sense, is accepted as a child of God and thus liberated from the ethnocentric confines of traditional Judaism and from the secularizing servitude and meagerness of their lives under the rule of the Empire of Rome. So if we wish to follow Jesus as the Messiah, as the Christ, then we will live a life today that continues his work and his teaching that expands from Judea out to our part of the world here in Calgary, and we will think and act like him. And we will be the vehicles through which God today will bring his love, his generosity, his goodness to the age in which we live, with the hope, certainly, of a greater fulfillment of all that Jesus stood for in the age to come.